$1,000 income boost. The workaday majority of Americans now find that their hourly earnings are lower than a year ago. But who cares? Being a trumpeter Republican means never admitting your lies and never apologizing. Steve Mnuchin, a former Wall Street banker who's now the Treasury Secretary, is a perfect example of a blasé, ethically challenged Trump huckster. He recently shrugged off the failure of the bloated tax cut to raise working people's income. Wages are going up on some people, he declared disingenuously. This is Jim Hightower saying, yeah, for multimillionaires like him. Yet he wonders why most Americans despise him and his ilk.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's program, we discuss the issue of an underground gasoline leak at the Midtown corner of 31st Street in Cleveland, Kansas City, Missouri, a historic example of the great power of community involvement. Joseph Jackson will be the guest of Richard Mabium. Joseph Jackson is a veteran of the United States Air Force and former member of the Kansas City, Missouri School Board and treasurer for the Kansas City Public Schools. He's a community advocate and former neighborhood president of Santa Fe Area Council and member of the Kansas City Neighborhood Advisory Council. But first, the environmental news of last week. Associated Press reports the EPA is pursuing rule changes that experts say would weaken the way radiation exposure is regulated. The Trump administration already has targeted a range of other regulations in toxins and pollutants, including coal power plant emissions and car exhausts that it sees as costly and burdensome for businesses. The government's current, decades-old guidance on threshold levels of radiation says that any exposure to harmful radiation is a cancer risk, and critics say the proposed change could lead to higher levels of exposure for workers at nuclear installations and oil and gas drilling sites, medical workers doing X-rays and CAT scans, people living next to Superfund sites, and any members of the public who one day might find themselves exposed to a radiation release. Supporters of the EPA's proposal to raise the threshold of radiation exposure argue the government's current model, that there is no safe level of radiation exposure, forces unnecessary standing for handling nuclear events. They argue that a bit of radiation damage is actually good for you, like a little bit of sunlight. The proposed new rule would require regulators to consider various threshold models across the exposure range when it comes to dangerous substances. This release was written during the tenure of the former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. The radiation regulation is supported by a Trump transition team member of the EPA who's known for challenging man-made climate change and the health risks of tobacco. U.S. agencies for decades have followed the policy that there is no threshold of radiation exposure that is risk-free. A majority of the studies directly support the principle that even low-dose exposures cause a significant increase in cancer rates. None supported the theory that there is some safe threshold for radiation. However, supporters of the proposal say it's time to rethink radiation regulation. Right now, we spend an enormous effort trying to minimize low doses at nuclear power plants, said a nuclear plant designer. Instead, let's spend the resources on minimizing the effect of a really big event. The Guardian reports, this week, scientists are gathering in South Korea to draw together the last 5 years of advances in climate science to answer key questions for policymakers. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, celebrates its 30th birthday this year with what is likely to be a landmark report to be released on Monday, 8th of October. What is expected to emerge will be the strongest warning yet that the unusual occurrences of extreme weather will add up to a pattern that can only be overcome with drastic action. Of particular concern is the decline in thick ice that forms over several years, which has stopped forming.
Good evening. This is Richard Mabian, and welcome to Eco Radio. Boy, this has been quite a month. I say that every time I get on the air. It seems like that it's continuous. Something is happening that is causing people to have to give attention, take attention away from whatever it is you're trying to accomplish and pay attention to the other things that's going on. You know, I am so glad I'm not a politician. As much as I know it takes politics to make this world go around. I will be so glad when this election is over. It seems like you get that way every time there's an election cycle. And you know and I know that between now and the November voting date, we're going to be ready to get hit with a barrage of commercials and comments. And, you know, the local folks haven't even got started yet. We got a mayor's race going on in Kansas City, Missouri. It haven't even got started yet. All the commercials we get now is dealing with national politics now that we didn't got through the Supreme Court thing. And I'm just telling you, it's very dismal to sit at home and one commercial after another berating each other. And when that person goes off, the person that just berated the person comes on and they berate the other person, and then you go from one race to the next, and there's one after another and one after another. And then when we stop and think about the circumstances that we're living in our city, I mean, my guest tonight and I were just talking about the series of triple homicides that's going on now. Now it's not just killing one person. Now it's killing three, four, five at a time. I've been totally disgusted with the people who feel that there's nothing wrong with standing up in the crowd and just starting to shoot. What mentality do you have to take a pistol and just shoot it into a crowd of people who most are done nothing, but yet and still very little comments by any of those politicians have had anything to say about the circumstances that we have going on in our communities. And so it makes you sit up when you're hearing all the berating going on. And you go, wait a minute, you know, who's going to deal with what's happening in my neighborhood? And that's kind of what this show is about. I keep coming up with these new themes. And my original one from the first of the year was bringing in folks who've been engaged in this environmental movement for the last 10 years, starting in 2008 to 2018. And I've been bringing them on, and we've been talking about the good old times back with the stimulus money and all the excitement and the buildup and the hype in 2008. And then I have the people talk about the good, the bad, the ugly that they've experienced up until now. And then we ended up with where do we go from here? And that's what I've been bringing on folks to do it. I got several more people lined up to come in, some old stalwart folks that when you come on, you'll know who they are if you know anything about the environment in Kansas City at all. And you'll hear you have a chance to hear them and I having this just a frank conversation. But tonight I wanted to do something different. And we were having our production meeting. Someone brought up the question about what's the update information on that gas leak over there on 31st, what is it, Indiana, Linwood,
Cleveland.
To see how it's really vague to us exactly where it is, but we know it was there. And old Mike said, well, why don't we get Joe Jackson in here? And so we made contact with him, and that's who I have in here tonight. Joe, why don't you introduce yourself to everyone?
I'm Joseph Jackson, a guest here on the Eco Radio, but I also host Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM every Thursday. But I've been active in the community since I retired from the military. I've served on the school board from 2010 to 2014. I was a treasurer for the last 2 years. I've been a neighborhood president of Santa Fe Area Council for 5 years, from 2012 to 2017. I was on the board for 12 years. I've chaired the Mayor's Commission for Neighborhoods for 5 years, and I've also served as executive director of the Historic East Neighborhood Coalition, HINC, which is a coalition of 13 neighborhoods during the time that we were dealing with the gas situation there from Inner City Oil. A little bit of a background on what happened.
Before you go to it. Now, I want you to understand that when I qualify someone to be here to conduct the conversation, I'm just not reaching out into the crowd and grabbing somebody by the coattail and say, come on, let's talk about this. I want a qualified person. And he just gave you a rundown of who and what he has been. And I'm sure we all have to agree he's a qualified person. Now I'm going to set the stage for where we're going. The incident that happened out in Tonganoxie was very impressive to me. We also had a group of young ladies.
What was that incident?
The incident had to do with Tyson. Trying to put a chicken plant out there in Tonganoxie. And it disturbed the people in the town. I mean, it disturbed them to the point, that movie, I'm mad as hell and I ain't gonna take it no more. That's the mentality that they had. And from that mentality turned into such a powerful base, community involved action that they were able to stop Tyson, a major organization, in their tracks, and caused them to withdraw their decision to build that plant. That's powerful, people, and it needs to be known. I will always talk about that because, see, my whole life is community engagement. That's what I do. I do it from the different perspectives, but being involved in the community is my life. That's my profession. So when I started realizing and seeing what happened, and I'm getting ready to let Joseph, where you go, Joseph or Joe? I heard you introduce yourself as Joseph. What is it?
Joseph's fine.
So when Joseph was getting ready to tell you, give you the background on what we're talking about tonight, I stopped him because I wanted to set the temperament of what we're trying to accomplish. Now you got it, buddy.
Well, there's a gas station still operating, Inner City Oil, right there at the corner of Cleveland and 31st Street. Back in 2004, they were changing out the tanks in the ground. And unbeknownst to them, one of the tanks had a hole the size of a pin in it. I still can't to this day understand why the tank was not water tested before it was put into the ground to ensure that it was,
This was a new tank.
This was a brand new tank. It came from the manufacturer with a defect.
Okay.
And it seemed like somewhere between the manufacturer and before it was put into the ground, the tank should have been water tested to ensure that it was safe and didn't have any leaks, but this wasn't done. So then the tank was put into the ground, and they started to figure out that they were losing the amount of gas they were putting in. They were not getting those relevant cells out of the tank. Come to find out, that tank was leaking a gallon of gas a day. Every time they filled it up, it was right in the side and the seams, it would leak out. To put it in perspective for you, a tanker truck holds 8,800 gallons of fuel. From the time that they were notified until the time that they really started to do something about it, 4,400 gallons of fuel had went into the ground.
Well, that's half a tanker.
That's a half a tanker truck. Hmm. And then when you used to drive over there during the time that it was raining, it would smell like you were pumping gas because the fumes would come up out of the ground. What we need to understand is the gasoline goes into the ground. It's not like you can get a giant vacuum cleaner and suck it out. It forms what's called a plume. That plume does not stay stationary, and it begins to move as it gets into the water. It gets into the sewer. It begins to travel. Well, that plume started out right there at that corner, and now that plume has moved. It's to the next corner over, and it's going in a diagonal direction toward 70 Highway. So there were that sign that says when you're pumping your gas, gasoline is a known carcinogen, and exposure to fumes can be hazardous. Well, now people started to develop cancer that lived over there. When they were living in their homes and it rained, the smell was coming up through their sewer systems into their house. And we then started talking with Representative Brennan Ellington, which we then got to Congressman Cleaver's office, because there was a couple who had bought that little restaurant right there. They were at the corner, and they were going to name it Smacks, and they were going to open it. And they couldn't open it because the parts per million of gas, of vapor smelling there was that bad. And it's with gasoline, you can actually drop a match in gasoline. Gasoline is not harmful. It's the vapors that come from the gasoline that are more harmful and they're more explosive. And that was the problem. The service station did over $1 million worth of work trying to, you know, cap it off. They finally had to dig the tank up and bring it out of the ground. But by that point in time, the damage was done. How that one situation was handled was totally different. As you right here down from KKFI Studios on 37th and Main, there was another gas station that had a situation. Those tanks were put out of the ground within a year, replaced, the station was closed. But you look at what happened on the east side of Kansas City, this was allowed to linger for over 10 years.
All right, so we know that the environmental problems and circumstances and concerns in the low-income community, especially those that are people of color communities, suffer the least amount of concern and consideration, which comes back again to this community. The community reaching a point of saying, how did you start the initial conversation with folks about enough is enough kind of an attitude? Where'd that come from?
We would have monthly meetings. The Historic East Neighborhood Coalition would have monthly meetings, and it would become a topic every month.
Okay.
That the smell was bad. And at one point in time, we were having a meeting at the church, which is right there at the corner of Linwood in Cleveland, and we had two state representatives there. We had Representative Brennan Ellington and Representative Bonnie Mims. And then another state representative, Randy Dunn, walked in, and we had opened the windows up, and the gas smell was coming into the church a block down. So getting people to understand that this was becoming a serious problem was that point in time when those three state representatives were there, that this then became a major point. So then the Department of Natural Resources came down, and they started going around, and then they started looking at they were drilling test wells to see how far the gasoline was down, and people started getting access to that data information, the test wells, where the plume was. Then the gas station could no longer deny certain things at that point, and it was when a lawsuit was filed against the gas station because the neighborhood and the community came together and said enough is enough. We've suffered through this for 10 years. Some of their loved ones had died in that situation from a unique forms of cancer that can only be gotten from long-term exposure to gasoline.
You know, I the one reason that I am so adamant about these shows being heard is because I want people out there listening to understand individual responsibility is a necessity from this day on. There's no way we can sit back waiting for some government body to decide, hey, that's a problem, we want to go in and benefit these people, because it's not happening. It's not happening. How many years did you say it had been there? 10 years?
10 years.
10 years that people had to suffer through those consequences. You know, and when we talk about what happened up in Flint with the water, that was a 2-year problem up there, and people think that that was horrible what those people allowed themselves to be subjected to, and the governing body the knew that this was going on and allowed that to happen to people. But now you come here in our own community, our own backyard, we're talking about a situation that was going on for 10 years. I heard you say that the service station finally agreed that it was a problem, which means that before they agreed, they was acting like it wasn't a problem.
Exactly, because it wasn't something that impacted them. They didn't live in that community. But go back to what you were saying, change only happens when people take action.
That's it.
And people take action when they begin to bed up with a situation. And the people there had watched a loved one come down with cancer. They had to deal with the rain. They had to deal with the smell. And then they started to call their city council person. They started to call their state representatives. They started to call their United States congressional representatives, Department of Natural Resources, begin to take action. And it was that action that led to situation being, it's not fully resolved at this point, but the houses that were in the most dangerous part, those have been bought in. The people have moved out. But there's still some people that are across the street that are still there. You know, they came in and they offered people, some cases, a little bit of money for their homes.
Let's talk about that. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to start right there. Folks, this is Richard Mabian at KKFI, and I'm sitting here with Joseph Jackson, and we're talking about that situation over there on Cleveland and 31st. And I want to give out the number here. It's 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. If you'd like to join us in this conversation, we'd love to hear your comments. We'd love to hear your input. We'll be right back with you. Thank you.
The Jackson County Bar Association presents Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. Classes are from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Greg Kleiss Community Center, 1600 John Buck O'Neill Way. The next class will be October 10th on Family Law. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
Native and invasive crayfish square off on this current cast. Crayfish are an important part of the food web in streams. But in Pennsylvania, an invasive species called rusty crayfish is taking over. And in some areas, they're so dense, they stack on top of each other. Dave Lieb with the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy says rusty crayfish are bigger and more aggressive. And they'll eat just about anything, including fish eggs, algae, and insects.
When you have an exotic crayfish invasion, many fish populations tend to decline.
Rusty crayfish were introduced by people dumping bait or unwanted pets into waterways. So today, it's against the law in Pennsylvania to move crayfish from one body of water to another. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, online at currentcast.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabee, and I'm back again. And as I told you when I started, this is going to be a powerful session here today, because it's time for us as the American public to become the American public and start taking direct responsibility for the things that's going on in our community. I got Joseph here, Joseph Jackson, and we're talking about that situation. Now, we cut it off. You were getting ready to go into the follow-up to you all being able to start in that. I'm picturing a community meeting. You got folks living in the neighborhood.
That's what we have.
And you're sitting there, and this, even though you got other stuff to talk about in the neighborhood, kids going to schools and the buses and the this and the that and the this and that, this would always end up being a topic. It wasn't the meeting, but it's a topic. What are we going to do about that leak? So finally you get to a point where you got some action and it occurred. So give us a little picture of how that happened, how that evolved.
It came up at so many different meetings that we started to have a special meeting for that, and we had reached out to the city councilmen. We'd reach out to our state representatives, and we'd even reach out to the EPA to get them there. So we had them at the meeting because you want to know what the dangers that you're dealing with. And what people may not understand or may not know is that there are hundreds of tanks buried across the state of Missouri.
Yes.
And there was a change in policy prior to the 1980s. You had to dig those tanks up out of the ground. But what they did was they changed the policy and says that the tanks could be left in place, but concrete poured into the tank, and you couldn't leave any more than, I think it was 10% of the fuel in the tank. Well, after a while, even if you put that fuel in concrete, it's going to start to degenerate. Some of those tanks were steel. They're not the new ones that they use now,
right,
that are plastic. Those steel tanks begin to disintegrate rust.
Yes,
and now
yes.
You got fuel elements, and gasoline is a known carcinogen, right. But it's not one of the 150 chemicals that make up gasoline. It is one of the few things that it's not included on Superfund site. So if you have a fuel leak, you cannot use the Superfund site
to deal with it.
Missouri does have a petroleum storage tank fund that can be used with it, that every time you buy gas, a certain percentage of that goes back to the petroleum storage fund, so that when they have situations like this, that they can dig it up. And you know, right there at the other cross from the other corner, there used to be a Amoco, an Apex station right there. If you go around the other block, there was a Conoco station. There was another station right there, the Amoco. And those tanks at that station had to be pulled out of the ground because they had another situation. And there are a lot of places in the city where there were formerly gas stations that are now certain situations, certain other buildings. Case in point, the Palestine Senior Citizen Center sits on a site that used to be occupied by three different gas stations, even though those tanks were pulled out of the ground. Wow. That Senior Citizen Center sits right there. I grew up right there. There was one on the corner. There was one next to it, and there was another one next to it. And those tanks, while they were pulled out of the ground, they had to do a lot of digging out of that because the gas is still there was still gas still was leaking in certain places when it leaked, you know, from the old tank. So all of that had to be pulled up. And that dirt just can't go to a normal landfill.
Right.
That dirt has to go to a special landfill. There was another situation right there at the corner of 82nd Street and Prospect where you turn. There was an Amoco station that used to be closed for about 5 years. They had a problem where people were having gasoline come back up through their drain pipes into their homes.
See, yeah. This is one of those kind of circumstances that I'm hoping they will be able to educate a future generation to take these on, take charge of this circumstance, because that's where it's got to come from. And as hard as we have been into this fight back thing for so long, that the diplomacy that we need to have in engaging in these conversations is what I think happened in your group, and also happened out there with the Tonganoxie group. It wasn't standing around with pitchforks in your hand ready to burn the place down. It wasn't we going to come up to your house or come up over you while you sitting down eating dinner and start yelling at you and your family. This was more of a diplomatic approach where you had common sense. You had facts and figures and that. Say a little bit
and
about that.
We couldn't fight that way. We had to sit down and explain to them what we knew, was going on, and what needed to be changed and what needed to be done and how it was a health risk for the people that lived there.
Right.
And once that started coming about and coming out, then everybody wanted to say, well, it's not my situation, not my problem. And we're like, it's somebody's problem that this community is suffering and this community needs help.
Right.
And we asked that question, and we had to get the state representatives to help us. We had to get our United States congressmen to help us. And those were the things that then we began to see action. You know, when the Department of Justice in some cases came in, and the Missouri State Attorney General filed a lawsuit because they had missed a couple of deadlines. You know, it wasn't about, as you said, pitchforks and wanting to burn things.
Yeah.
It was about sitting down at the table and having a conversation about what we needed to do and what the steps we needed to do and how we needed to do it.
You know, David Corton, and this is for you all out there, he was the guru of me being in the environmental world. He wrote this book called The Great Tourney, And in there, he made a statement, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but he said that the leadership for the world to come would be coming out of the communities that had suffered the most injustices in life. In other words, they have had to learn how to diplomatically approach problems because the old pitchfork days are over. They know how to handle that. You think about it, when they protest things around this country now, they don't get anywhere close to where the meeting's going on. They'll be so far away, they got you isolated off in some corner. They know how to handle that stuff nowadays. But when the leadership that was shown in your neighborhood is the kind of leadership that's going to have to be learned to be able to address the circumstances that we're dealing with in life. I mean, if it's the goods movement with diesel trucks that are flooding our community, and we're going to have to be able to sit down at the table with these folks and negotiate out what we're talking about and why that's a problem for us in our community. There was some brothers there at Harvard, and I think California Davis wrote an article on how pollution was affecting the violence. They had done research and found out that when the ozone was up, the level of violence going on in low-income communities went up. We had him on this show. We called him up and talked to him about it. And this was a legitimate thing. So I'm sitting up going, we got people dying multiply across our community, after this triple, these multiple murders week after week after week. When are we going to stop and realize that maybe some of this has to do with the pollution factors that's going on out there in the community? Maybe that underground gas that everybody wants to overlook could in time have an effect on the way people are behaving.
Well, it definitely has an impact on the quality of life. Because now these people were coming down with different types of cancers that weren't common to that. And then that begins to, you know, there were some people that were on oxygen because, you know, gasoline destroys the lung tissues. And that's why it was so important for them to get the people out of there, number one. But as you said, we have to be at the meetings.
Yes.
And we have to call the people that are responsible. And then they came up with different tactics where they would counsel. You have to continue to stay active about it. They would cancel meetings. They would make a meeting and then cancel it. Oh, so-and-so couldn't make it, so we cancel the meeting. But let us know when the meeting's going to be. Well, we're going to call you and reschedule it. If we haven't heard from you in a week, then we're calling you, because if you're rescheduling and our rescheduling, you're only going to reschedule it if we put enough pressure on you to make you reschedule the meeting. Otherwise, it's a waiting game, because if we can wait you out, then you'll get tired.
Right.
And the community's going to have to determine that we've had enough.
That's right.
We're not going to take what's going on, but we're going to march upon City Hall and have conversations with the people responsible and let them know that we're going to continue to be here. We're going to be at the next meeting. We're going to be at the next meeting. And a great example of this is I was on the school board in 2010 when they shut off all the lights across the city. And I showed up at the city council meeting and with our city council representative for the third district. And I said, I have an issue. I'm a director of the school board. We've shut off all these lights in areas where it's critical for kids to cross the streets. And they said, well, we didn't know anything about it. And I then called the city and I said, well, you know, we need to sit down and have a conversation about this. And they were like, we're not going to cut the lights on. And I said, well, my daddy has a phrase, I can show you better than I can tell you. We began to sit down and write letters. I talked with parents. I had parents make phone calls. We had community meetings. But the community did not stop.
That's right.
The community continued to push because it was an unsafe situation. We kept that up for a year. As you see today, the lights are back on.
They're back on. The lights you're talking about are the...
The stoplights. When they put the... Like at 35th and Prospect, they turned off all the stoplights and put in four stop signs.
Oh, okay.
And they were trying to get that. And they did it right there at the corner of Linwood and Cleveland. They did it across the city at over 59 different sites. And
cutting their costs.
Electrical costs. Well, it wasn't electrical costs. What it is the new lights in town have to be ADA compliant.
Okay.
To put in a corner of stoplights, you're talking at $2 million. and that the city has to pay for that. And they were telling us, well, every neighborhood city council district gets PIAC, which is about $3 million a year. And they said, well, you all could use your PIAC dollars. And we're like, we're not going to use our PIAC dollars for something that it'd be like taking a thimble and trying to put out a fire, because it would take us 50 years of using all the PIAC money just to put the lights back on in our community. This was a citywide situation. This was a citywide problem. And they thought that they could save money on the backs of different communities. But the community and the city came together, and we advocated, and we got the lights turned back on. That is the type of advocacy that it's going to take in this city to be able to sit down with your state representative, your city council individual, the mayor, your congressional individuals, and let them know different things that are happening. You know, violence, we cannot begin to change the community, right, and transform the community if the community is not a part of the conversation and at the table. I have a phrase: either you're at the table or you're on the menu, but either way, you're going to be on one or the other.
Right, the other. You know, the thing about it is that the system has created what I consider plastic leaders for us. I don't mean to embarrass anybody or offend anyone by saying it. So they don't have to come to you. They don't have to come to the neighbors. They go to this person that's been designated as a so-called leader in the neighborhood. And that person really very rarely ever says anything to people in the neighborhood. So the opinion really just comes from them. So, in fact, that person who has this designated spot has not really been attuned to what you and I are sitting here right now, because I know for a fact many of those designated leaders that they have in town have never mentioned what's going on over there on Cleveland. Never. And I'm, you know, that's my business to know that. And I've been around them, and I've never heard them say a daggum word about what's happening over on Cleveland. But those are the people they'll go to when they say, well, what's going on in your neighborhood? And they'll talk about the standard SOP kind of subject. We're going to take another break here. I mean, again, I'm going to throw out that number to you, 816-931-5534. Give us a call. Thank you.
What's that sound, you ask?
It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Amanda Rideau did not want to sell the home where she'd lived for 13 years, but the memories of floodwaters rising were too much for her two young sons. In mid-August 2016, heavy rains hit their Louisiana parish, dropping 30 inches of water. Rideau was at work when her older son called.
He said, Mom and Daddy wants me to tell you that there's water in our bedrooms. And I said, what do you mean, honey? He said, what's coming through the walls?
The family evacuated to safety, but the experience was frightening.
It was a hard day. It was a hard day for all of us.
Rideau's five-year-old son struggled the most, even after the family renovated the house and moved back home.
When we'd pick him up from school in the afternoons, he would just cry and not want to go back to that house. And we realized that we couldn't fix it, even with counseling and therapy. And so we just recently moved.
Psychologists have found that extreme weather events put children at risk of PTSD, depression, and anxiety. So mental health impacts can linger long after the floodwaters are gone.
It's a form of trauma that I can never take away from my children's lives. They're going to have that in their memory forever now.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This is Mike Murphy jumping in here. Just we had a caller. She didn't want to be on the air, but she did want me to ask this question about the health department and what she sees as carelessness with regard to their air quality program and how that relates to this.
That is a two-sided sword, because the air quality only really changed when it rained, and it changed at the rain because it would come up out of the ground.
Yeah.
And every time they would go over there, they would sit and say, we can't find anything. And then we started getting copies of the test well information we were seeing. Then we could track where the plume was when we started asking the Missouri Department of Environment to give us copies of that. We could see where they had drug test wells. We could see where things were going. And, you know, the health department never really came. They seen it more of since it was a gasoline leak, it was a little bit different. Instead of something that, say, if you destroy, one of the things the health department is looking at now is, say, when you destroy a building, demolish a building, now what happens to air quality within the community? And now they're changing that, and they're putting out sensors. They're going to be demolition of the building Willard right there in Blue Hills, and they're putting out air sensor qualities, and there's so many different things that have to be looked at now as far as making sure that you wet down the building to keep the dust down, that you only demolish really in the wintertime when it's the particles are heavy and air doesn't travel. When you start to do things like that in the summertime, air is lighter and it moves all over. So there's a lot of different things that have to be looked at now.
You got in it.
They'll come out of that.
I'm going to come back to that question, the person that called it in, but we have another caller in, because I want to say something about that too. We have another caller. Caller, you are on the air. Will you tell us the part of the city you're calling from and give us your first name, please?
Yeah, I'm Midtown. My name is Murray.
How you do, sir? May I help
all
you?
All right.
Can I help you? What's your question, buddy?
I just got a phone call. I'm sorry I wasn't listening to the program earlier, but I understood that y'all were talking about 31st Street down there and didn't seem to have anybody calling in with any information.
Well, no, we okay on that, but what we're talking about, and you can address this too, buddy, and I apologize. I should have called you and told you about it, and that's just the temperament. I mean, my schedule nowadays. What I'm doing is highlighting community engagement and why that's important. What I'm doing is trying to show why people like yourself, myself, others of us out here who are beating the drum about what could and should be done or what is actually going on in our communities need more citizens to step up to the plate, like the guys and the girls did out there in Tonganoxie when it came to the Tyson problem with the chicken. So you can speak to that because you're very much aware of the fact of being the lone wolf and how much better it would be to have people that live in those communities that are stepping up to the plate. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can speak to it. And you're right. You're 100% right. The people that live in the community, that's living with that situation day and night, that's living with it when it rains or when it picks up, when it seems to get worse, they need to go and talk about it. They need to go to their leadership, go to the health department. They need to raise some sand. They need to, I'm not trying to be political. I'm not going to be political. When they first brought this subject up, some leaders came out there, the governor and a couple of other people, and they talked about how bad it was. They did, the governor and these other people. Well, where are they now? They talked about the smell, how they were afraid to light a cigarette out there, how they didn't want to light a match. But when those people drop off and don't say any more about it, that is when you should raise sand. Call the health department. Call the Missouri Division of Natural Resources is totally, totally inept. They're totally in the pockets of corporations, and they don't want to raise any sand because of the legal things that it would take them into. Yes, people people, you people that live around these things, you need to raise sand. One person cannot help you at all.
Thank you, Mr. Copeland. You were very timely, and you said exactly what we needed to hear, buddy. Let's you and I talk sometime quick, okay?
All right.
Thank you, guy, for calling in. I want to go back to, you know, Maurice is a standard bearer for me and all of us here at the station, especially me and my borough. He and I have been out here fighting this battle for some time. And you got to love the guy because he's given his heart and soul to the survival and the fitness of our city. But I wanted to get on to back to that health department question. Was that a lady to call? I agree with you that we're not receiving, and Maurice mentioned it, what we should from our health-related facilities. When we have problems like that, it seems like they are more concerned about the status quo than they are about the people who we love that are dying, our children. I mean, just like he said about the lights going out where the kids at across the streets. We have to become responsible. And the reason I had this show was to say that it's the individual responsibility of the people who live in these communities not to come together to fight, not to come together to try to overthrow stuff, but to start coming together and using the intelligence that God gave us to be able to diplomatically work with neighborhood people and make sure that these problems are continuously being addressed. I'll tell you my secret. I go to ministers. I consider them to be missing in action. If nothing else, they don't have to agree with it, but I think every minister in this city on Sunday morning should say to their congregation, I'm not telling you what to do, but it's been shown that a lot of the illnesses that exist in our community can be traced to the food that you eat. That's all. I'm not telling them to tell folks not to eat it. I'm not telling them to tell folks how to eat it. But I'm just saying, if I had my way, that would be something that every minister in this church on Sunday mornings would say, just as a public service announcement. We got a couple of minutes left. I want to be able for you to be able to
wrap this. One of the things that people need to understand is that the people who reside within the third district have a lower lifespan than people who reside across, as you said, because of food, because of different things that happen in the community. The disparity gap is great in certain zip codes in Kansas City. There can be a 12-year gap in the amount of lives that the person in the third district and other districts will, city council districts around that, versus people that may live in the Northland. And that comes back to health care, education, food, the quality, education, all these different things that people really need to know.
Thank you for coming in. We're going to wrap it up, y'all. I'll be back again next week. Have a good one.
Now the calendar of events for the week of October 8th. Tuesday, October 9th, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Fellowship, 4775 Southwest 21st Street in Topeka, the Sierra Club will sponsor Doing Environmental History, the Chisholm Trail as a Case Study. Contact Duncan 888@AOL.com. Wednesday, October 10th, 6 to 8:30 p.m., Kansas City, Missouri Poor People's Hearing will be at 6140 Swope Parkway, Kansas City, Missouri. October 11th, there's a free screening of The Guardian at Spencer Museum of Art, 1301 Mississippi, Kansas University, Lawrence, Kansas, 5:30 to 8 p.m. An indigenous community in Mexico confronts internal divisions and illegal loggers in order to recover the ancient forest they nearly destroyed. Like the millions of monarchs that also call this forest home, their survival depends on it. The screening will be followed by a question and answer with Dr. Orly Chip Taylor, Director of Monarch Watch. Friday, October 12th, 10 to 11 a.m., there will be the Brush Creek Confluence Trail opening at Blue Banks Park, 4701 Denver Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Saturday, October 13th, Food Not Lawns sponsors Lawn Eradication 101, 1 p.m., 118 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Turn your lawn into a garden and your neighborhood into a community. Also Saturday, October 13th, 9:30 a.m. to 12 p.m., Blue River Glades Litter Cleanup. Volunteer to clean up litter in the Blue River Watershed near Swope Park in Kansas City, Missouri. You have to be 16, and all volunteers must register in advance by completing online registration. Contact John at 816-944-2383 or email john.fish@bridgingthegap.org. Also on October 13th, Saturday, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., the Alex George Wetland Restoration is sponsored by Jackson County Parks and Rec and Heartland Conservation Alliance. This will be at Alex George Park, 10700 Blue River Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Appropriate clothing includes rubber boots if you're able to be on the lake edge tree planting crew, long pants, long sleeves, closed-toed shoes. They suggest hats, sunscreen, bug spray, and a water bottle. They'll have donuts and coffee available. Call Heartland Conservation Alliance at 816-759-7305, extension 1148, if you have any questions. These events and more are available on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at kkfi.org on the Eco Radio page.
The Jackson County Bar Association presents Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. Classes are from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Greg Kleiss Community Center, 1600 John Buck O'Neill Way. The next class will be October 10th on Family Law. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio.
Is the U.S. government weaponizing insects? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's been 3 years since about 200 countries met in Paris and agreed to try to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So how are we doing? We have already passed 1 degree, and according to a report to be released October 8th, we are on track to hit between 2.7 and 3.7 degrees by the end of the century.
The formal document is by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, and has been prepared by experts, scientists, and representatives from 150 countries.
They are expected to say that to keep the temperature rise down to 1.5 degrees, the planet would have to limit carbon and other greenhouse emissions to net zero, where carbon released into the atmosphere is captured.
Even if the 1.5 degree goal were met, there will still be problems like Arctic ice decline, sea level rise, and more damaging weather events.
The U.S. has said it's pulling out of the Paris Agreement, and now there's the possibility that the large economies of Australia and Brazil may also leave.
Achim Steiner, a UN official, offered some hope. He told The Guardian that there's been extraordinary progress in the past few years in renewable energy and the adoption of low-carbon technology. He said, "We can do this. We can bring down emissions. It doesn't need to be a disaster."
While the IPCC was meeting last week about global warming, the Trump administration signed a new trade deal with Canada and Mexico, which makes no mention of climate change.
The new agreement, called the USMCA, contains many of the same features of NAFTA that environmentalists say promote fossil fuels and pollution.
As Inside Climate News reports, USMCA has new provisions that make it easier for corporations to challenge environmental regulations in other countries even before they're adopted.
A section of the new agreement called Good Regulatory Practices permits companies to comment on proposed regulations in other countries. Further, the governments are required to consider the burden regulations place on small businesses and whether rules place unnecessary restrictions on competition.
Under the new pact, companies will still be allowed to move polluting activities to countries with weak regulations. And if one of the countries adopted carbon limits, businesses could outsource to where where there were less stringent standards.
The deal will have to be approved by Congress, and the American Petroleum Institute, an oil and gas industry trade organization, is urging it to do so.
A group of scientists and lawyers is warning about a first-of-its-kind program funded by the U.S. government that could use insects to spread genetically engineered viruses to alter the chromosomes of crops.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency says its program is aimed at improving crop security by making plants resistant to disease and drought. Aphids, leafhoppers, and white flies would be used to spread the virus to crops such as corn and tomatoes.
Writing in the journal Science, the authors claim that the project is developing biological weapons, which have been banned since 1975. They fear that other countries will feel compelled to develop their own bug warfare.
In justifying the research, the agency says that it's developing ways to respond rapidly to threats to the food supply. But the critics say using insects as the dispersal method makes no sense when the viruses could be sprayed on plants, as farmers do with pesticides.
One of the authors of the critique told the New York Times that once you engineer a virus that spreads by insects, it's hard to imagine how you would ever control it.
In 2017, researchers found that hospital sinks are a source of bacteria which colonize in drain traps. Bacteria are dispersed when running water allows tiny droplets containing the germs to become airborne and spreads them up to a meter away.
A hospital in Israel recently found it was difficult to contain the bacteria after they traced infections in patients to the sink traps.
The problem began in 2016 when the first of 32 infections were detected, which caused 3 people to die. Investigators found the source of the contamination in 22 sinks in an intensive care unit.
To combat the problem, the staff decontaminated the sinks frequently using bleach and different techniques, but that was only a temporary solution.
They then restricted access to sinks in patient rooms, allowing them only to be used for necessary hand washing. They also banned all waste disposal in the sinks. Using these practices, they report in the journal Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology that the outbreak was fully contained.
There's good news. In a separate study published in the same journal, researchers have been able to create a sink drain cover that would keep running water from splashing microorganisms up from the drain and into the sink and surrounding areas.
And finally this week, we go to Yellowstone National Park, where tens of thousands of tourists flock each year to see its world-famous geysers. Visitors were a little less entertained, however, when an eruption in September spewed something other than the expected hot water, steam, and rocks.
On that day, a sleepy little geyser named Ear Spring, which had been dormant for some 60 years, belched out some foreign objects 30 feet into the air, according to the Yellowstone Facebook page.
Among them, tin cans, part of a cinder block, crumpled foil, a pencil, a plastic cup and spoon, cigarette butts, a sign that seems to be a warning about bears, lots of coins, and of course, a plastic straw.
Yes, garbage that had been marinating in the geyser's hot springs for decades was being forcefully thrown back at visitors. Park officials decided that some of the items were historic, like a baby's pacifier from the 1930s, and they'll likely put it in Yellowstone's archives.
That said, the Park Service is pleading with tourists not to treat the geysers like fountains where people toss coins for good luck. In fact, they warn tossing an object into a hot spring can damage or plug its plumbing and stop it from functioning altogether.
Wishing you good fortune, that's This Week in Water. We'll see you next time.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, highlighting the latest cost-effective strategies to manage aging infrastructure at the Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 28th to 31st in Atlanta. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Do you have a car, boat, truck, or motorcycle that's just been sitting there or is a real eyesore? Why not donate it to KKFI and get a tax deduction? To find out more, call Bill at 816-994-7869. This is Colleen Moorbach, a volunteer at KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station.
We're killing our plants and animals. Animals consider eating anything. All that trash can't be digested, causing death. This also goes for our plants. Piles of trash are ruining and killing them. In some animals that decompose, you would see all the trash that it consumed. The most we can do is educate people by having public speakers go to schools to educate on the topic and having litter laws where it's needed. With no litter, we would have a beautiful environment and live in healthy conditions. This is brought to you by J.C. Harmon High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.